Okay, hello everyone. I'm here with Miguel Altieri. Maybe a name you're not that familiar with, but by the end of this, I hope you'll have a greater understanding of who this person is and how important he is. Someone I met actually several decades ago and finally tracked down, and we're going to have a conversation. Miguel, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Hi.
So, who are you? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a 67-year-old person that was born in Chile, in South America, and I came here to the United States about 40 years ago. I studied agronomy in Chile, and then I did some work in Latin America, and then I ended up doing a PhD in the University of Florida on biological control of pests. And then I came to Berkeley as a professor of agroecology in 1981. So I've been here for 38 years in the faculty, teaching agroecology and also working with small farmers in Latin America and many other parts of the world.
Are you still at Berkeley? Because when I called there, they didn't know where you were.
Well, I'm an emeritus professor now. That means I retired, but I'm still active. I teach still a practical class called Urban Agriculture that the students really like. I also teach agroecology. And the reason why they asked me to teach is because they don't have anybody else to teach these classes, because they are practical classes where students learn how to plant and grow plants and living things. And most of the new professors are all into modeling and computers and genetics, and they don't really know much how to grow crops, you know, in a sustainable manner. We lack now the type of professors that we had in the past that knew how to work in the field and identify insects in the field, and now they all need labs and computers to do that.
So Miguel, you use this word agroecology. What's your association with agroecology?
Well, agroecology is a science that basically what it does is the science of designing sustainable, resilient, socially just agricultural systems. And it's based not only on the contributions of ecology and other modern scientific fields, but also it also involves the knowledge of traditional farmers, which in Latin America, we're lucky because we have farming communities that have been farming for 5,000 years or more, and their systems have stood the test of time. So we have a lot to learn from them. And so what agroecology does is tries to create a dialogue of wisdoms between the two fields, the two ways of science, both the scientific, the Western science and the folk science. And from that, we derive principles. And those principles then take different technological forms depending on the agro, you know, the biophysical and socioeconomic conditions of each region. So the principles are universal, but they take different technological forms depending on the realities of the rural communities.
Well, are you being a little modest? Because didn't you kind of invent the whole agroecological movement?
Well, We've been
the modern version.
Yes. I wrote my first book on agroecology in 1982 when it came out in Spanish, and then it was translated into English in 1987. So really, agroecology was born pretty much in Latin America. Although here in the United States, we have had, you know, several people have major contributions to agroecology. One of them is Professor Steve Lisman from University of California, Santa Cruz, who also wrote a textbook on agroecology. And he's also retired. So it's interesting that he and I came together to California in 1980, and we both retired, and we were not replaced by agroecologists. So pretty much the fields of agroecology at the University of California, in my opinion, are dying. The original form of agroecology, because now agroecology is in vogue, everybody's talking about it, but there's also a co-option of agroecology going on, a co-optation of agroecology going on.
Well, that's a good lead-in to some questions I want to ask, because what is the relationship of agroecology to sustainability, a sustainable agriculture, that word that's thrown around so much?
Right. Well, you see, it depends on how you define sustainable and what is it that you want to sustain. If you go to the website of Monsanto or other corporations that are promoting, you know, big business, big agribusiness, what they want to sustain is their systems, you know, their corporate industrial agriculture. That's what they want to sustain. So they talk about sustainable agriculture, but the way they define it is it's very different from other people like myself. For example, to me, sustainable agriculture is a goal. It's not a method of production. It's a goal of development. And what everybody says, well, sustainable agriculture is an agriculture that is environmentally sound, socially just, economically viable, culturally sensitive, et cetera, et cetera. But when you get into the nitty-gritty of defining what is socially just, then that's when the politics come in and the different political perspectives collide. Because for me, socially just means that we need to do land reform to give land to the peasants, because they are the ones that are feeding the world. But that obviously, that definition of socially just doesn't go along with the definition of Monsanto, or doesn't go along with the definition of the organic farming movement, which in this country has become very, very elitist, because only the rich people have access to organic food. And to me, we need to democratize the food system so that the right to food is realized for everybody, not just for the ones that can afford the healthy food.
Wait a minute. Now, you said the peasants are the main ones supplying food to the world. That can't be true. I mean, it's after the Green Revolution, Monsanto and all these guys, they must be doing it, yes?
Well, it turns out that it's not my data. It's data from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization that has shown, and many other reports show, that small farmers, which are about 350 million farmers in the world, occupying 20% of the land, using 20% of the water, 30% of the fossil fuels, producing no greenhouse gas emissions, are the ones that are producing 70% of the food that we eat in the world. Corporate agriculture, which occupies 80% of the land, which is only 20% of the farmers, using 80% of the water, 70% of the fossil fuels, and producing 35% of the greenhouse gases, are only producing 30% of the food that we eat in the world. Because they are really not interested in producing food. They're interested in producing biomass. So, you know, biofuels, bioplastics, biopharmaceuticals, whatever. If food is something that is profitable for them, they will produce it, but that's not their main objective. So these people using most of the arable land of the world are not producing the food, and they're the ones that are causing climate change.
I love you, man. Okay. I want to ask a few other, how agroecology is associated with this other thing now called regenerative ag. What is that about?
Well, you know, there's a lot of new terminologies that are coming out, you know, regenerative agriculture, or climate smart agriculture, ecological intensification, even biodynamic agriculture, organic agriculture, permaculture. There's a lot of terminologies out there. And to me, agroecology is the science that provides the principles on how do you design an agriculture that is resilient, that is sustainable, that is productive, that is diversified. So if people want to call it regenerative agriculture and they use the principles, that's great. So it's a regenerative agriculture based on agroecological principles. But there's a lot of what they call regenerative agriculture that is not based on the principles, so it's not agroecological. The same with organic. In organic agriculture, we have 35 million hectares of organic certified agriculture in the world. About 80% of it doesn't follow the agroecological principles. They're monocultures based with input substitution. You know, they use, instead of chemicals, they use organic products, botanical insecticides, microbial insecticides, et cetera, to a point where I know farmers here in California that use 18 different products, you know, in vineyards, for example. And many of these products contradict themselves. For example, sulfur, which kills diseases, can also kill beneficial insects that you want to also have in the system. So basically, that agriculture doesn't follow the agroecological principles.
Okay.
And then on the other hand, there's a lot of farmers that follow the agroecological principles, and they decide not to call themselves or certify themselves as organic. So basically what agroecology is the science that allows you to study all the systems. I can go to a permaculture farm and understand it from an agroecological perspective. I can go to a biodynamic farm and see if they're applying or not the agroecological principles. And many times they are not, although they're applying their biodynamic principles, which is fine. But from an agroecological perspective, they're still weak. And the other thing is that what is interesting is that social movements in the world, especially the small farm movements of the world, have taken agroecology as the flag of their food sovereignty strategy. And they have not used other terms because agroecology is much, much closer to their rationale because it was born in the South. You see, permaculture was born in Australia. Biodynamics was born in Germany. Regenerative is kind of a U.S. kind of terminology, and it's not really ringing a bell in the South where most of the peasants live. You know, 80% of the small farmers or more live in the South, not in the North. So to me, there's no contradiction. I mean, if somebody wants to explain their systems from, you know, with the principles of Steiner, fine. But it doesn't meet the agroecological standards sometimes, those systems. So there's no contradiction. You could improve those systems with agroecological principles. And in fact, I work with some farmers here in California that are biodynamic, and they have monocultures, but I, you know, help them to diversify them, and they don't have to abandon their biodynamic principles. They enrich their systems with agroecology.
Let's talk about the philosophical underpinnings and these principles you've been talking about. Tell us about the principles of agroecology.
Well, you know, agroecology, and this is not something that we scientists or researchers invented. This is something that small farmers that have been farming for thousands of years have done. They observed how nature works, and then they basically mimic that in their systems. So the first thing that they realize is that in nature, the systems are diversified. They are not monocultures. And so they started growing their crops in very complex patterns, agroforestry systems, intercropping systems, you know, where biodiversity plays a major role. And then by assembling these different crops, not just because they want to have a rich diet or a diversity of crops per se, is that they started assembling crops and observing that there were interactions between these crops that were complementing each other. For example, corn and beans, you know, that they can complement each other nutritionally. The beans feed the corn with nitrogen and phosphorus through mycorrhizal associations. The corn provides pollen for beneficial insects that control the pest on the beans. You know, the milpa, the system of the small farmers of Mesoamerica, is full of interactions that are the product of these interactions that happen between the different components, the different plants that are complementing each other. So what agroecology tries to do then is use these principles of synergy, recycling, diversity, in order to create systems that are able to sponsor their own function. They don't need, you know, external inputs. Once you have the assemblage of crops and animals and trees and soils that are going to be able to set in motion these ecological interactions that are going to promote the processes that are fundamental for agriculture to be productive. So, you know, what do you need for agriculture to be productive? You need nutrient cycling. Well, for that, you need microorganisms in the soil, organic matter, okay. What else do you need? Well, I need regulation of weeds and diseases and insects so that they don't take off. Well, for that, you need, you know, predators and parasitoids and antagonists, all these beneficial organisms that need to be present in the system that are going to be sustained through associations of crops that are going to provide the habitat and the soil conditions for them to thrive, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way agroecology works. It's kind of ecological engineering. But what is rich about this is that also it's accompanied by a knowledge that is millenary. So we need to learn from the traditional farmers, not only how they use the plants, but the knowledge about predicting, you know, the climate, variability, how to manage the soil, how to keep the biodiversity going, and so on and so on.
So it's hardly top down. It's more bottom up, where you respect these traditional farmers and what they know.
Yeah.
And incorporate that and validate it through science.
Yeah. And then the way, and actually we don't even validate it, because most of the time what we, you know, through years and years of research, basically what all I do is just figure out that the systems are correct and then facilitate a process of transfer, horizontal transfer of knowledge between the farmers that know and the farmers that don't know this information. And that's how agroecology is being transmitted, through what is called the campesino-campesino, peasant-to-peasant, farmer-to-farmer networks of horizontal exchanges of information, and they have their own way of transmitting. So we don't need the extension system or the research system for these farmers to be able to innovate and to exchange information. So our role is more like facilitating the process. And then, obviously, I can do research on the systems and find out how it works. And then those mechanisms, I can transmit them to other farmers, for example, here in the United States. You know, what we learn from farmers in the South, we can apply here. And there's a very important example of that. In Brazil, in the south of Brazil, many farmers, small farmers, created a system of no-till organic agriculture, which in the U.S. is totally dominated by you know, is managing monocultures with the herbicides of Monsanto, Roundup, and other herbicides. Well, they figured out that by growing a cocktail of cover crops, if they smother them and leave them as a mulch, then they could plant their crops in the absence of weeds, because when the residues start decomposing, they release these chemical substances called allelochemicals, which accumulate in the first 2 centimeters of the soil and where 99% of the wheat seed bank is. So all the weeds that will be there will die, and the crop would also die, but the farmers figured out that they needed to plant it deeper. So at 4 centimeters, they plant the corn and beans, and then the corn and beans come up through that toxic layer without being affected with the absence of weeds. Well, it turns out that system now is being used in many parts of the U.S. by organic farmers, but they took technology directly from the peasants in Brazil. The only thing is that they never compensated those farmers for the knowledge.
How much of how things have gone wrong is because of corporate greed or because of our kind of scientific bias that's based on, like from your book, atomism, mechanism, universalism, objectivism, and monism, as opposed to holism, contextualism, subjectivism, and pluralism?
Yeah.
How much of it is the greed part, and how much of it is the orientation, you might say?
Well, they're both connected, because the science that we practice in conventional agriculture is based on assumptions of people that gave certain perspectives to agricultural science. For example, the first one was Descartes, who basically said, you cannot study the whole, you need to understand by dividing in parts. And that's how we became specialized in agriculture. If you want to study agriculture, you're going to study insects and soils and pathogens separately in the university. You're going to take classes that are all specialized classes, because the assumption was that by understanding the parts, you would understand the whole, and that never happened. The second one was Darwin, which actually, although perhaps he didn't think about this, his message wasn't this, but the main thing was, you know, that was taken from Darwin was the law of that evolution was driven by competition, by the survival of the fittest, whereas in nature there's much more cooperation than competition. So we left aside all the interactions, all the positive synergies that could happen, and we emphasize on competition and to try to limit the competition. So eliminate all the insects, the weeds, everything from the system because they're competing, without understanding that there could be some beneficial interactions. And then obviously Malthus had something to do with our thinking, because you know most of the thinking about hunger in the world is all based on Malthus, that because we have so many people, we have hunger, and what we need to do is increase production with high technology, when hunger doesn't have nothing to do with production. It has to do with poverty, with inequities, with maldistribution, with lack of access to land, many other issues. And then finally, there was a German von Liebig who came up with the principle of the limiting factors, that there always going to be a limiting factor out there that is going to be limiting your production. Insects, weeds, you know, all the competitors, which actually open the gates for these big corporations that actually inherited from World War II this chemical technology to declare warfare on the competitors. And that, you know, gave rise to the monoculture agriculture that we have today. So greed and science are connected, because actually much of the science in the university is being funded by big corporations. I mean, Berkeley receives $500 million from BP, British Petroleum, to produce, you know, genetically engineered biofuels.
I was there, by the way, because I sponsored a project that Pimenthal did, in part, right when BP mm-hmm. made that contribution, $500 million, to basically totally undermine what Pimenthal and other guys, the good guys, were doing to show, hey, trying to get ethanol from corn is a ridiculous proposition. And the only way that it works is because it's subsidized. But BP wanted to shove it right down their throat and sideline these guys. So they gave them $500 million to do it.
Exactly. And what happened is nothing came out for the public, whereas biological control, which was which started in California in the late 1800s, actually saved California $1.9 billion in pesticides, just the research that was done at the public university at that time. That group, when I came in 1995, it was closed down, despite all the benefits to society. And then they went in for Novartis and for other big corporations' monies, which never yielded anything for the public good.
So I just want to go over these five, because we're going to talk about, you know, what you've written. But there's this this primary book, Agroecology, the Science of Sustainable Agriculture. It's second edition. You've edited it and contributed to it. So just from that, these five things that I mentioned, these kind of philosophical underpinnings of modern science. Atomism posits that parts can be understood apart from the systems in which they are embedded, and that systems are simply the sum of their parts. Mechanism posits that relations between parts of a system do not change, a necessary condition for prediction and control. That's why so much of this work is done in laboratories as opposed to out in the field. Universalism posits that the heterogeneous and complex world around us can be explained by the interaction of a relatively small number of universal principles. Objectivism posits that our values, ways of knowing, and actions can be kept apart from the systems we are trying to understand. Monism posits that our separate disciplinary ways of knowing are merging into a coherent whole. And basically every one of these, when you take a look at living systems, in particular soil-based living systems, you know, are wrong.
Right.
So, you know, it's holistic, it's systems-oriented, there's context that creates meaning that is totally ignored by these approaches. You use this term subjectivism. Social and most natural systems cannot be understood apart from our activities, our values, and how we have understood and hence acted upon these systems. And pluralism, complex systems can only be known through multiple different patterns of thinking, each of which is necessarily a simplification of reality. So talk a little bit about the social aspect of agroecology, because almost no other systems really incorporate that as part of their science.
Yeah, well, agroecology perceives agricultural systems as the product of the coevolution between nature and social groups. I mean, humans started manipulating nature and selecting crops and through millennia, and there was a coevolutionary process in which the societies that treated nature correctly and developed the systems, agricultural systems that would be based on this agroecological principle survived, and the ones that didn't collapsed. I mean, if you read the book of Collapse by Jared,
right.
What's his name?
Yeah, Jared.
Then you'll see that many of the a civilization that collapsed, like he describes, is because the societies went overboard in terms of exploiting nature beyond its capacity. And nature included many agricultural systems. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that food production, it has a social role. You know, the main role of food production is to convey food for people, for all, not just for a few. So there comes the dimension that, you know, of equity and so on, that is important. And that food needs to be produced in land. There's a social function of the land, and that comes to the point of that the land has to be in the hands of the ones that produce it, the ones that produce food, which are the peasants, the small farmers. So there comes the political dimension that we need to do land reform. We need to give the land back to the people that produce the food, that take care of the soil and the genetic resources and the water and so on. So this social dimension of agriculture is not only just a sociological dimension that we need to understand, that the co-evolutionary process, and then that we need to understand the knowledge that the farmers have, that have accumulated for centuries, but also the dimension of the social function of agriculture and the land. And that the main objective is to produce food for all, to realize what is called the right to food. And that's when agriculture then collides with the big interests that are not interested in realizing the social function of the land and agriculture.
Which is the foundation of what we're calling food sovereignty.
Yeah, food sovereignty basically is very different from food security. A country can be food secure. Like, for example, Iowa is food secure, but it's not food sovereign because it imports all the food that it eats instead of, with the exception of corn, soybean, and pork. But the rest all comes from outside. So they have the power to buy it, and that's why they are food insecure, but they are not sovereign. So in order for us to realize food sovereignty, we need to realize, first of all, the access to land of the people, and then the access to the modes of production that are going to make them autonomous so that they can produce without depending on Monsanto or other institutions. And then we need to realize the right to food through more solidarious market arrangements, not the markets. It's a bypass. So we talk about that the food system is controlled by about 5 corporations today. They determine what farmers are going to produce, how much they're going to produce, for whom they're going to produce. And at the same time, they control what the consumers eat, you know, the big supermarkets, how much you're going to pay, the quality of your food and all that. We can create a bypass to that. But in order to create a bypass, we have to have autonomous agricultural territories managed by organized peasant organizations supported by people that are providing the knowledge and the techniques of agroecology. And then through very collaborative, solidarious arrangement with consumers, then they are able to create these alternative markets that are going to realize the right to food.
So, by the way, it's Jared Diamond, that's his last name, that wrote the book Collapse.
Yes, right, Jared Diamond. Yeah, yeah. Now, there are many examples of this bypass that I'm talking about. Because people say, well, farmers markets, you know, that could be part of the bypass. Yeah, but if you go to the farmers market here in California, for example, in Berkeley, you're not going to find any Latinos or Afro-Americans buying there because the food is pretty expensive. So when I'm talking about a bypass, I'm talking about alternative markets that are not totally ruled by capitalist rules. I mean, they exist within the capitalist society, but there are other solidarious arrangements in which the transactions between farmers and consumers is not totally ruled by capitalist goals. So, for example, I know communities in Colombia, in Brazil, and in Nicaragua where the farmers are selling their produce lower price than the conventional food to the consumers, because these consumers are loyal to them and they support them, and so you create this solidarity relationship between these people that are basically transacting with money, but on other terms, not just totally ruled by the market.
I want to read something that I wrote for a conference in the UAE, Arab Emirates. Uh-huh. It's a few paragraphs, and I'd like to get your reaction to it.
Okay.
So, first, some definitions. We define food as primary ingredients, or that which is made from primary ingredients, using processes that do not alter the fundamental integrity, wholesomeness, and healthfulness of the primary ingredients used. A primary ingredient is water and also a natural non-synthetic nutrient with a fully disclosed one-word ingredient statement, which is neither genetically modified nor produced using GM technologies. Now, the reason I started that was because we keep throwing this word food around, but we actually don't have a definition that, for me, is real food. So that definition I just gave throws out about 90% of what you can buy in a supermarket, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
We define food sovereignty as self-sufficiency in the production of all nutrients, including water, and wholesome, healthful, and nutritious land-based foods, fruit, vegetables, grains, livestock, and water-based foods, fish, seafood, and distribution of those nutrients to the population as required in sufficient quantities for the population to thrive. And of course, you've added the whole dimension of who owns the land, which I'm going to go into in a second. We define sustainability as that which at worst is benign and preferably beneficial to the quality of air, water, and soil. Sustainability can also be viewed through three lenses: material, where the rate of use is less than the rate of replenishment, with the goal of emulating as much as possible nature's closed nutrient loops where there is no waste, since the waste products of one process become the feedstock for another. Energy, another lens, where all secondary sources of energy, even so-called renewable sources, are derived from our sun. So the closer we can get to the direct use of sun's energy, the more sustainable we are likely to be. And through an economic social lens, where the key to financial sustainability is to create profitable markets for sustainable products and processes that allow communities to thrive. So now I want to go to this experiment, which I did, which you know about because you introduced me to these guys, where I went to Mexico. I found somebody who, two folks that were highly educated, that were very intimately related with the peasant culture, with the campesino culture down there, that were farmers, that knew how to do stuff in addition to understanding the science. I gave them a fair amount of money to, and my condition was that the farmers had to own the land. There had to be no debt. And so I gave them a fair amount of money to do an experiment. Because at the time I was consulting with a very large supermarket chain in Canada, the largest as a matter of fact. And I said, I'm gonna try to show this supermarket chain that we can create incredible product, get rid of all the middlemen so we can deliver it directly to them. So we're creating a market for sustainability for these guys. And it's basically all organic because they never used any other inputs. So I provide irrigation, I provided a tractor and seed and so on. And I tell you, they produce some of the nicest stuff I've ever seen. And I couldn't get these guys in Canada to do anything about it. So there are, from my perspective, we don't need Bill Gates and his organization going to Africa telling these people how to grow food and putting his GMO solutions and vaccine solutions and everything else on a country. And from a position of total arrogance and ignorance, we need to create markets for these guys. They need some infrastructure. They need some cooling. They need some trucking, you know, transport. They need some warehousing. And ultimately, they need somebody to buy their damn stuff because they have the capability, they have the know-how to grow some of the best damn stuff that you can find anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Your reaction?
Yeah, well, There are dangers of bringing these people into, because what you're talking about is them bringing them into the capitalist economy, and the field is not leveled. So you know they could go in the route that you're talking about, you know, and have the warehouses and all this stuff and the people that buy them, and then you know they're going to be competing, because unfortunately, the markets are driven also by not only by supply, but also by demand. And demand changes because the people are so manipulated here by the media. So sometimes they might find, you know, at one point you have consumers that are buying from these Mexican farmers, but then, you know, somebody else comes in and says, well, why don't you buy from these African farmers? And then you start putting, competing these people, and they get into the logic of the market. So although I agree with you that they need infrastructure, they need markets, it has to be part of a bypass. It cannot be within the logic of capitalism. It has to be a different logic, a different alternative markets that are not totally ruled by the capitalist mentality. And that's the challenge.
There were going to be, you know, contracts for supply. And there was also one of the other basic rules I had is that food sovereignty had to be in place so that they would never export anything that the community needed first. But what happens,
Harry, is the experience, for example, with fair trade, which has similar objectives to the one you're talking about. When fair trade goes into communities, it creates a lot of stratification because there are only a few farmers that are going to get into this cooperative, and they're going to be favored by your grant or your donation, and then the rest of them are not. So there's going to be immediately stratification within the community. And this is happening tremendously with fair trade approaches where they go into communities, they find the coffee they like, but not everybody can produce that coffee. So basically creates an animosity within communities and division, brings things that they were not there present before.
Okay, that's very significant. And of course, my thing was ultimately to include this entire peasant population through all Latin America. But I'd like to hear about some of these alternative channels that you're talking about. How do you envision it?
Well, there are some that are occurring. I mean, there's a major network in Brazil, southern Brazil, called Ecovida, which is basically a group of farmers and consumers together that have come up with their own cooperatives, and they have come up with their own certification schemes that are participatory. They don't need somebody to come and certify them. And they have their own rules of engagement in terms of, you know, how much the price of the food, so that both the consumers and the farmers get fair share. That's one aspect. The other one is through policies. When social movements create enough political demand so that there are politicians that are going to come up with policies that are going to favor agroecology, that's another approach. For example, again, in Brazil, in Nicaragua, and in other countries, there are what we call institutional markets. For example, Brazil has a law, the National Law of Agroecology. That wasn't because some illuminated politician said, let's have an agroecological law. It's that the social movements pushed the politicians to create them. And with that law, what it does, it has many aspects. But one of them is that buys 30% of the production of the small farmers has to go to the institutional market, to the social markets, to the schools, to the hospitals, to the elderly people's homes, and so on and so on. So that takes, you know, 30%. If you're a small farmer, the government buys 30% of your food, and that's assured. That takes you out of the logic of competition in the capitalist market. 30% of your income comes from the government. And the government, on top of that, is saving money because they were buying before from big corporations. Now they buy from farmers. And the food that they serve is much healthier. So in the long term, it has health benefits, which lowers the bill for the health bill for the country, which is enormous, as you know, in this country. You know, the health bill is huge because it's very much associated with industrial agricultural diet.
I've tried to figure out a way to do something like that here. Basically, have a cooperative that's farmer based, with a captured consumer base, and of course it's being done in small scales with these, consumer agricultural cooperatives. Where they have you know, 100 customers or something, and you get a share of whatever's produced by the farmers. But I think there's a huge opportunity because people want to go direct. Disintermediation is a huge thing. And instead of having Amazon or Walmart be the disintermediators, if we can figure out a way to develop those direct relationships with the farmers. And farmers markets do that, but exactly what you've said, with rare exception, the food is priced out of the range of a lot of people. So the people that need it the most can't get it.
Right. Right. And the other thing that is very important to mention, Harry, that I've been working on in the last years too, is the development of using agroecology to promote urban agriculture. Because what happens is that in the year 2030, 70% of the population of the world is going to live in cities. And the cities of 10 million people are going to triple in size and numbers. And one city of 10 million people has to import every day 6,000 tons of food that has to travel 1,000 miles on average. That's totally unsustainable. For example, when there was the earthquake in Tokyo about 2 years ago, the food lasted in the supermarkets one day. So can you imagine here in the Bay Area with a big earthquake, you know, and all the bridges go down, there would be a total chaos because there's no access to local food. And if we do urban agriculture like the Cubans do, you know, where they have 50,000 hectares of urban agriculture providing about 30% of the food of the major cities, producing about 20 kilos per square meter per year per food, we could actually make, I made the calculations for Oakland, it's a city nearby here, where there's 1,400 acres of abandoned public land. If we put that land, you know, to production, having half of the productivity of the Cubans, 10 kilos per square meter per year, we could produce enough vegetables to feed 400,000 people. But that's not being realized. That's a food desert. That area is full of food deserts because there's no political will to put this land into production for resiliency and for food security in the city.
And Cuba is a good example of a country because of blockades and that all these inputs that they were depending on for agriculture were basically cut in half or worse. So they had to develop.
Yeah,
they had to develop agro, exactly. Basically an entire country based on agroecological principles, and they ended up going through a rough time, but then ended up having basically an entire organically produced agricultural system with that involved huge numbers of people, great cooperation,
yeah.
and healthy foods too, right?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, things have changed a little bit because with tourism now, you know, there's a lot of restaurants and hotels, and all these Europeans and Americans that are coming are demanding fresh food. So all this food that was being produced in urban agriculture for the local food security, pretty much of it now is going to feed this foreigners that are demanding for fresh food. So that's what happens when you start opening up a country like Cuba to the world economy. The market and the demands from the people that come there, you know, start undermining what the achievements were of the revolution.
I want to talk about a couple other concepts. One is the concept of yield. We seem to be in conventional agriculture so focused on it. And by yield, though, they define it as kind of unit per area, but there's lots of other ways to define yield, right? You could say per unit of labor input or per unit of cash investment, but also energy efficient ratios. So from what I understand, traditional farming is much, much more energy efficient than conventional. Something like 3 inputs to 1 output as opposed to 10 or 15 inputs to 1 output. Is that correct?
Yeah. There's a lot of studies that have been done on these systems, and they have found that they have energy efficiencies of, you know, 10, 15. So that means you put 1 kilocalorie of inputs and you get 20, 30 back. In Cuba, I know farms that have 30 values of 30 of energy efficiency. So that's a totally solar-based agriculture. But the way we measure productivity in agroecology is with, since we're dealing with mixed systems, we don't deal with monoculture. So, for example, you can have small farms are they can be 20, 30, 50 times more productive than large farms when you look at total output, not just the output of one crop. Because, for example, you could compare a small farmer that produces corn with a large farmer in Iowa that has 2,000 hectares of corn. That guy produces probably 18 tons per hectare. The small farmer produces 1 ton per hectare. Then you conclude that the large farmer is more productive than the small one. But then when you start talking about total productivity, it turns out that the large farmer only produces corn, and the small farmer produces corn, beans, eggs, cows, pigs, chicken, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then when you put that total output, then you find out that they are much more productive than small than large farms. And then when you look at the ecological footprint of how it is produced, you know, in terms of energy, in terms of soil loss, in terms of water loss, in terms of this and that, whatever indicator you want to use, the systems have a much lower ecological footprint. And so the benefits for society, the positive externalities to society, which are not valued by the neoliberal economic system, are much higher. So in order to address the productivity, we need to look at it from broad lenses. And that's where there's a new hybrid science called ecological economics that looks at the real cost of food, the real values of what are the positive or the negative externalities for production system.
And in your book, even though it was from the 80s, there's quite a good chapter on the way that they account. So natural, what they're calling natural resource accounting. And by the time you're done, you find out that the so-called $80 a profit under conventional financial accounting becomes a $27 loss under more complete economic accounting. So when you put in subsidies, when you put in externalized impacts, like you were talking about soil and so on. So it's a very uneconomic system that only exists because of these subsidies, it seems.
Right. And actually, in our studies, we have found that you need usually 50% more land to produce with conventional agriculture to produce the same that we get in agroecological systems. Because when you intercrop corn and beans, you're basically overlapping two systems. So that system has, we calculate what is called the land equivalent ratio. So we usually get values 1.5, 1.7. That means that you need 50%. If you get a 1.5 LER, means you need 50% more land in monoculture to get the same amount of productivity that you get in one unit of polyculture.
Do you think that market forces alone, if they're legal, they're transparent, they're ethical, can provide the proper type of solution that we need, or do we need policy? Is it important that we have governmental policy so that we have food sustainability and food sovereignty?
Yeah, I don't think free market. I don't believe in free market. I think that market has to be socially intervened. And that obviously that's something that people will not accept in this country because that's kind of socialism. But basically, if the markets were never invented to account for social equity. So you need to control them. You need to intervene them. And one way to intervene them was the example I was giving you before. You know, it's like, okay, you know, we're going to buy the food of the small farmers, and with that food, we're gonna feed the schools and the hospitals instead of buying it from corporations. That's one way of intervening in the market.
If you were in charge of the USDA and you had the power and ability to get done whatever you wanted to, what would be some of these things? What would you do?
First of all, I would bring into the board and the commissions and the committees of that farmers so that there is a partnership between farmers and researchers, and that the research agenda is determined by the input of farmers, the local farmers. So, because obviously it has to be site specific. And so you would need to bring farmers into the universities, into the USDA, to have participatory research agendas that are going to respond to the real needs of farmers and consumers, and not to the needs of the big corporations or the ideas of researchers, which many times were all formed in universities and have been penetrated by capital anyway.
So right now, science has been corrupted substantially by money.
Well, science is at the service of capitalism. Science is not neutral. You know, here people in campus, I had many, many discussions because they said that I was pseudoscientific because I would bring politics into the discussion. I said, well, science is not neutral. You know, it's at the service of whoever holds the power. So if you want to have a science for the people, that takes a very different form from the science that you guys are developing here, which is responding to corporate interests, which are funding the research anyway with millions of dollars.
A quote from your book, "The final requirement of an ecological agriculture is an evolved conscious human being whose attitude towards nature is that of coexistence, not exploitation."
Yeah, well, that's getting philosophical, but basically I think that ultimately, and given the challenges that we are facing as humanity today with climate change and ecological degradation that we're undergoing, I don't think that science and technology is going to be enough. I think we need to have some kind of a jump in consciousness. You know, I think the change is as much as internal as societal. And that in order for us to be able to change, we're going to have a conversion, you know, internal conversion, where people realize, you know, that the way to survive in this planet is going to take a totally different paradigm and a totally different way of relating with nature. You know, we cannot continue consuming at the rate that we're doing it. At this point, we need about, in order to have the style of living of this country, we need about 10 planets. So we cannot afford that anymore, and we need to make changes. And that those changes have to be also accompanied by internal changes of consciousness, where, you know, I don't want to have so much. I want to be more rather than have more, and that kind of thing.
By the same token, if we did things right, I think there'd be a lot more abundance for more people as opposed to this scarcity model that we're operating under.
Right.
That concentrates wealth among very, very few. So this planet is amazingly abundant.
Yeah.
Nature has provided us an incredible path if we're able to understand it instead of trying to out-engineer it.
Yeah, but nature didn't provide us with cars and cell phones and stuff like that. It provided us with resources that we should use, you know, in an intelligent way and producing things that are really useful. And, you know, I think that half of the stuff that we consume is not necessary. We could live without it. I think you and I, when we were children, we lived a totally different life than the children today. You know, and I see my grandchildren that have probably 80% more than that I used to have in terms of things. And I remember having a very happy childhood without any of that stuff.
Miguel, what are you doing these days before we close down here? Tell us a little bit about the projects you're involved in.
Well, Harry, I'm very much involved with a society called SOCLA, which is the Latin American Scientific Society of Agroecology, which is a group of about 800 researchers, students, professors from different universities of Latin America, working with very, very closely with small farming communities. And we're promoting all kinds of teaching, research, educational programs. We also have some on-the-ground action projects. For example, right now we're organizing a group of farmers from Haiti and Puerto Rico to visit Cuba, so that they can observe some farms that have resisted the passing of hurricanes. There's a lot of farms in Cuba that have been able to show resiliency against hurricanes because of the way they are designed based on agroecological principles. So we think that it's very important to make those links for these farmers to learn how to design these farms, because more hurricanes are going to come in the Caribbean. Although they didn't have anything to do with climate change, the contribution of a small island like Puerto Rico to climate change is nothing compared to the U.S., for example. But they are paying the price. And many other projects along these lines, we're very much involved in promoting. We have a program within SOCLA called Redagres, which is a network of people working on how to measure resiliency. How do you assess, when you go to a farm and assess whether it's going to resist or not a hurricane or a drought, and what do you need to do in order to enhance the resiliency of those farms to climate change. And then also a lot of lecturing and writing. I'm going to Europe and Latin America. I'm going to be in Montana in October, you know, giving talks. It's kind of a spreading the word. I always saw this work that I do as a more of a mission than a work, really. So that's what I'm doing.
In terms of your publications, just for our listening audience, if they wanted to get a book to learn more about agroecology, its principles, philosophies, and applications, what would you recommend?
Well, if they want more details about my work, they can go to agroeco.org. It's my website. It's not always very updated, but it's there. And then, you know, there's a lot of publications that are going on right now. I just put out a book with a colleague called Peter Rossett called Agroecology, Science, and Politics. It just came out by Fernwood here in the U.S. You can find it in Amazon, Rossett and Altieri, Agroecology, Science, and Politics. It talks about, you know, the science and the practice of agroecology, but also the political dimensions of agroecology, how politics is so important to be able to scale it up to the level that we need. And so there's a lot of stuff coming out.
I guess I want to close by saying every time I talk with you, and it's been quite a few years, but I'm always humbled because you're totally authentic. You have incredible scientific knowledge and theoretical knowledge, as well as incredible practical knowledge. You really care about people and the success of the people that are responsible for growing the food and making sure they get a fair shake. You have great respect for nature.
Well,
and the appropriate use of nature. So, I mean, you're an exceptional human being, an exceptional scientist, and an exceptional contribution to the agricultural well-being of the world. And so I wanted people to meet you and get familiar with you, and hopefully they'll follow up with you know, looking at your website and looking at some of these books that you've suggested.
Well, thank you very much, Harry, for the opportunity also.
So we're gonna talk a little bit offline, but Miguel, thank you again, and that's it.
Okay, good luck. Thank you very much. Thank you.